Thank you, thanks for coming. This is like a kind of a VR title. I'm going to be talking about closing grades. So, so first, what are closing grades? Closing grades are these charged particles that we have been observing on Earth for over 100 years now. And this is kind of the energy spectrum. Spans of 12 orders of magnitude, which can go also even more in that direction. And there is a peak around the few GeV for the cosmic ray protons. So these are the protons that come and hit Earth. This is like a...
So basically, these are basically the abundances of or the intensity of these cosmic rays, and you can see they fall in energy very quickly and spans in the energy about 12 orders of magnitude, and intensity it spans a few orders of magnitude. And basically, most of the energy in these cosmic rays are carried by protons with a few GeV, energy, few GeV. Just like these are protons that moving with the speed of light, basically. So I can like give kind of a few talks about why the research of cosmic ray is very important, but just gonna give you this quote from the decadal survey panel. I wasn't part of it, and they say that the impact of cosmic rays is one of the largest uncertainties in understanding galaxy formations, and the reason for that is that these cosmic rays basically excite tiny scale, which is AU scale or solar system size scale fluctuations. But this can drive winds on scales of 10 kiloparsecs. This is a million times larger, or 2 million times larger scales. So if you really want to understand like launching of galactic winds, and this impacts how many stars a given galaxy form, how you distribute metals, etc., how you amplify magnetic field in galaxies, you really need to understand these small scale fluctuations, because this is what actually dictates this. Well, some people would disagree with that, but I think this is the most likely thing. So cosmic rays, as we observe them, they're moving with the GeV energy, so they're moving with the speed of light. So if we think about a galaxy, like our own, it's like this galactic halo, and this is the bulge in the galaxy, and the height here is about 3 kbc. So if you think about something that is moving with the speed of light, you can ask how much time would it stay in the galactic halo. So the light crossing time is about 1,000 years. So if you reduce, you have a supernova, dies, produce some GeV cosmic ray protons, if they move really with the speed of light, and that is the whole story, they will just spend about 1,000 years in our galactic halo. But there is many lines of evidence. So first, you can look at the spallation product, the decay rate of lithium or beryllium isotopes, beryllium isotopes, or you can even look at the degree of anisotropy of cosmic rays that arrive at our planet, and the estimated time that the cosmic ray stay in the galactic halo is about 2 to 7 years. So let's say 20 million years. So if they are moving just freely, they will spend 1,000 years. Maybe if they move sideways, it's 10, 100,000 years. But we know that they stay much longer. So how can this happen? So of course, these cosmic rays, they have, you know, they're moving with the speed of light, and you want something that scatters them while they keep energy. So the best candidate of this is you have magnetic irregularities. And these magnetic irregularities, there is kind of two pictures in understanding this. I'm going to talk about this self-confinement picture where cosmic rays, while they are propagating in the galactic halo, they excite plasma instabilities, and they scatter off of these magnetic perturbations, and this is what confines them. So if you want to understand something like how they stay, what is the how much they heat, how strong the galactic winds they would launch, you need to understand these plasma instabilities.
The astrology, I know nothing about this. The astrology of different particles that make up cosmic rays.
Sorry?
So you mentioned all the variety of particles that make up cosmic from the cosmic rays. Mm-hmm. Are neutrons part of them? And if so, then they wouldn't be affected by this.
No, neutrons are not. Usually are not considered.
Is it understood that neutrons are also part of the cosmic rays?
I mean, like when you account for, okay, so when people usually try to account for the energy budget, so fusion EV cosmic rays, they have some energy density and you can compare this to the energy density of the, in the thermal or in the magnetic field or the kinetic energy in a galaxy like our Milky Way, they are in equipartition, but this doesn't account for neutrons. So I think if you add neutrons, this would change this energy budget calculation thing. But I don't understand why are you asking about neutrons?
I'm just trying to see the budget that I have of particles that are being accelerated by whatever means. This estimate here and your conclusion that okay, they will be trapped by finite interactions, but there will be some that I don't. So I'm just trying to do that.
Yeah. I think neutrons would not, you know, interact with magnetic field perturbations. Sorry?
That's true. I don't know what the production is.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah. I mean, it depends on where you produce them, right? They could have some energy, kinetic energy. But I think they wouldn't have the speed of light.
Yes.
But how abundant are they, right?
Yes.
Yeah, those decay moments.
Yeah.
But they can interact with the bar.
Like a neutron decay to a photon.
Yeah.
Free spontaneous decay, right?
Yeah, I mean, so if they... if their energy is high enough and they decay in minutes,
okay.
I mean, yeah. Okay, so... I'm going to give a bit of a simplistic picture of what plasma instabilities are. So if you look at a background of electrons and ions and put a magnetic field and ask what are the normal modes, these are the normal modes that are allowed to propagate in this plasma. If you hit a plasma with something that is not a normal mode, it would be reflected, and if you generate it inside, it would decay. So these are the normal modes that are allowed to propagate, and this is the electromagnetic branch, so this is electric and magnetic perturbation perpendicular to that magnetic field, and it rotates with some rate, and this is the rotation rate, and you have two branches. This is the one that's basically, these are at the large scale or a small k, these are Alfvén waves. And as you go to smaller scales, one of them turns to ion cyclotron wave. So this is wave that rotates with the same rotation rate as the ions. And then another one that in the intermediate regime rotates with the basically Whistler frequency. And these are Whistler waves that we already observed in the ionosphere, for instance. And then it turns to electron cyclotron waves, which is like waves that rotate with the same sense and the same speed as electrons would rotate around that magnetic field, B0.
So what is the rotation rate?
So this is the rate by which these electromagnetic perturbation around B0 would rotate by.
So this is just proportional to the frequency. Right?
Yeah. It's the frequency of the wave, yes.
The magnetic field irregularities you need to bounce these cosmic rays around, do they have to be produced by plasma instabilities and things like that, or could it just be sort of, I guess, how small scale do these irregularities?
Okay, you're asking about something I skipped, but that's a good question. So there is two pictures of how you confine cosmic rays. There is the extrinsic picture and there is the intrinsic or self-confinement picture. What I was talking about is this self-confinement picture where you excite magnetic perturbation through plasma instabilities, and this is what they scatter. The extrinsic, you need a large-scale turbulence that decay and then scatter these cosmic rays. The problem with this is that you have something called ion-neutral damping. So if you have a turbulence at scales much larger than AU by maybe a factor of 1,000, it would kill all these magnetic perturbation. See, maybe if you think about very high-energy cosmic ray confinement, you will think about extrinsic picture. Maybe a few hundred GeV. This is basically the typical number. But if you think about GeV cosmic rays, their confinement has to work in the self-confinement picture.
So They need to be very heavy number.
Yeah, exactly.
Sorry, Mohammed, I think I'm already very lost. So what are you trying to do here? You're trying to postulate there are some cosmic rays, and when you mean confinement, it's confinement in the galaxy?
In the galactic halo, yes.
So you're trying to see what sort of instability is. But let's say, why do I need to call for an instability? I could have some distribution of magnetic fields that would confine.
Where does it come from? That's the question, right?
Yeah, suppose I have it. Uh-huh. Why do I need instability? What do I need this for? If I don't have instability in the plasma, that's kind of not confined to the cosmic rays.
So this is the problem. If you have an extrinsic turbulence that decays to the scales of AU.
Suppose I have just some plasma, and there is no instability there. It's just
magnetic field. Just magnetic field? You mean regular magnetic field?
Yeah, or just have some. The question is, why do I need instability for? If I have already some plasma there, would I not be able to confine at all?
Yes, you wouldn't. You wouldn't. And the reason is, so the gyroscale for cosmic ray protons around a magnetic field of like 3 microgauss is about the size of the solar system, this one AU. If you have a magnetic perturbation with wavelengths that's much larger, the cosmic ray ions would just gyrate around this perturbation without being scattered. So you wouldn't be able to use this for scattering, for confinement.
You're going to scatter the cosmic ray with respect to what? If I have this structure, like just having gyrating around the galaxy without escaping, so I thought you're
so you want magnetic field that is long scale but doesn't escape the halo. How would you generate this?
I don't know. But
yeah, it doesn't work, right?
So dynamo, for example, the galaxy couldn't generate, the field strengths that are seen, without having small coherence lengths.
Yeah. So the dynamo picture. I mean, it's related to this extrinsic confinement. The problem is like the saturation level may be not very high. So.
Okay, so you can't generate the field strength that are seen just by a normal galactic dynamo.
Exactly.
Okay.
I mean, maybe you can generate something like this, but if you want to confine like the large scale magnetic field using the dynamo, but if you want to confine, you need something that's maybe 10 times larger than this. So you really need and instabilities that generate these magnetic perturbation.
And the scatter of the cosmic rays would be scattering with what?
Changing their forward momentum.
That's all.
So if you imagine like you generate, let's say there is a supernova here, it's a big point, tiny point here, that's a supernova explodes. Let's say these cosmic ray protons will come to us. They will come in a straight line if there is no plasma instabilities, and then we will not observe this isotropy in the sky. We will see batches of them. But the isotropy tells us that they have to scatter many, many times, so we don't have just a single forward moment.
So you mean these plasma instabilities boost the strength of the magnetic field?
Yeah.
And where does the energy come from? From
the cosmic ray. Yeah. Okay. So this is the self-confinement picture. So you magnify. I mean, how much amplification also is kind of a debatable thing. But okay, so the general picture of cosmic ray instabilities is that now once you add to this electron-ion plasma and electron-ion cosmic rays that they have relative drift speed, the dispersion relation or the normal moves will kind of Doppler shift in the omega k plane. So this is the same as if you have some frequency and it's emitted from a car that is moving, see the pitch higher and then lower when it's moved. So this is the Doppler shifting in the omega k plane. This is the rotation rate in the omega. So you get basically this branch from the cosmic rays is this red line. So as you can see here, you have this intersection and these are called resonances. What does it mean? That means that cosmic ray ions are moving, and in their rest frame, they are supporting ion cyclotron waves. And at some wavelength, the rotation rate of this wave that's supported by cosmic rays is the same as the rotation rate of normal modes in the background plasma. And this is a resonance condition. And, at resonances, you can exchange energy. And, of course, you have the free energy in the cosmic rays, so naturally it flows to the background plasma waves. So this is the instability, basically exponentially fast in the linear regime. So So we have resonances here. And so you have, like, in this case, you have four intersection points. And this is basically the meat of the new instability that we found a couple of years ago. So usually people talk about these gyroscale instabilities.
Sorry, what's your horizontal scale?
The k, the wave number, in terms of the ion skin depth. So basically, these are the so-called streaming instabilities that people usually study to study cosmic ray transport. And what usually people do when they solve the dispersion relation is go to the low, because it's very complicated, they go to the low frequency regime, which basically replace the normal modes of, you know, the electron ion plasma with an MHD wave modes, which is basically replaced with these two dashed lines, with two dashed straight lines at the initial slope here. So if you replace this, that's fine. If you replace this with something at the initial slope, you can see that you lose the resonances. So if you solve the full problem now, you get other resonances, and this is what we found. And surprisingly, the growth rate is actually much faster than the instability that people usually invoke for cosmic ray confinement. And this is with just, I reduced here the mass ratio just to bring the gap between the electron and ion gyro frequency.
Yes, so just to clarify, just instability sort of for all wave, or for the big scan of wave numbers? And just
yes. Yeah, at the resonances. Yes, exactly.
No,
there is a maximum growth rate, yes. That's basically given by how much forward momentum these cosmic rays, so this V drift, compared to the alphanic velocity of the background ions.
How do you get these curves? I mean, what do you solve? What are you?
Okay. Yes. So these curves come from solving the full dispersion relation. So basically,
what?
Yes. Yeah. So you have use kinetic description, okay, and you have many species. You have cosmic ray background electrons and ions. So you have a dispersion relation. So basically what you have is you linearize Vlasov equation and Maxwell's equations, and you combine them. This is the normal calculation. And then you have many terms. Terms correspond to background ions, background electrons, cosmic ray ions, cosmic ray electrons, and you solve the dispersion relation. So this is the normal procedure. And you get these different curves. This is the real part. This is the imaginary part. The reason why this is the red and this is red is that this is actually the imaginary part of this curve. So you get a complex number. This is the real part, which tells you how fast this electromagnetic perturbation rotate by. And this is how fast they grow.
What is BDR saying here?
Sorry?
BDR is a... No, I'm just asking the
problem. This one?
No,
I see. So this is basically, okay, sorry, yes. So this is the ion to electron mass ratio. And here I used, like, I think 30 or something just to put this in a linear scale and have still, like, you know, this is visible. Because the ratio between the ion cyclotron and electron cyclotron is the mass ratio. So MR is the ion mass ratio to the electron mass ratio.
And BDR?
The relative drift. This is the basically how much you Doppler shift this red curve. Yes, how much you Doppler shift this red curve with respect to that black curve. So basically the slope of this curve or this straight line is this VDR over VA in these three units.
So just for curiosity, before you move on, what does Kalkbrock do with these problems?
Sorry?
So if you're saying that this is not a solved problem that we cannot.
I'll touch it at the very end. That does.
Okay.
Yeah. So.
What is what?
Kalbrov. It's a cosmic ray transport. Famous school to calculate abundances of different elements.
That's cosmic ray physics. They don't use Kalbrov to simulate the propagation of the cosmic rays where.
So. So one word maybe to calm your curiosity. Kalbrov uses basically this diffusive transport that through many observations, and I'm going to talk about this, doesn't really work. So this is if you use a realistic mass ratio. This is a kind of parameter that are relevant for cosmic rays produced at the supernova remnant shocks. You can see this is the instability that people used to talk about, and this is the instability you found. It's much larger. It's about a factor of 20, 250 larger, depending on what kind of parameters you use. But this is the physics. This instability also has a condition. Once you increase the relative drift between the ions, the cosmic ray ions, and the background, you can see that these two beats merge, and then it, the instability, if you increase it even further, it ceases to exist. And there's a
just to clarify for me, so this V drift you're saying corresponds to the relative bulk velocity
of the cosmic ray ions, yes.
So
of the cosmic ray ions, yes.
Ions relative to electrons.
The background. No, the background plasma or the gas.
There's a background plasma with some rest frame.
Yes.
There's some bulk velocity.
And you do the calculation in the rest frame of the background plasma.
I see. Okay, so you have like some sort of like beam or jet or cosmic rays flowing through as a stream.
So it's imagine like you have a supernova, you know, explodes, form the shock, and then you accelerate some protons or something, and they get eventually injected into the interstellar medium. So this instability has a condition, and the condition, it's easy to understand. If we go back to this picture, basically this is the slope. So basically this is the case where you have two peaks. If you increase the slope, you get one touching point. And if you increase it even further, you don't have the instability. So it's an instability that exists only if these two peaks, if these two curves kind of have intersection points, so have resonances. So it's an instability that has
drifts, not of order one, sorry.
V drift over VA. No.
This V drift, I would think, would be order the speed of light, right?
This is after confinement, not before. So VA in, let's say, in the Milky Way is like 10 to the minus 4 C. GeV,
okay.
10 to the minus 4 C. GeV protons move with the speed of light. Right? So initially they are not. So usually people say that the scatter such that the effective drift speed after you saturate due to these instabilities drops to the alphanic velocity.
Once you scatter, then there's no more like bulk velocity, then there's just like randomized velocities, right?
Mm-hmm. This is the picture, yes.
But the calculation is assuming that there's this coherent bulk velocity of the...
So the picture you have is after you excite the instability and this scatter, you know, use the forward momenta to excite these magnetic perturbations and you scatter many, many times to slow them down. And then the stream...
Some sort of net bulk velocity.
So that... Okay, so if you look at this perturbation, this is why this comes from. This is where this picture you have comes from. This perturbation move with respect to the background with the alphanic velocity. So these are alphan waves. So if you scatter until you're at rest in the rest frame, so you lose all your forward momenta in the rest frame, with respect to the background plasma, you're moving with the alphanic velocity.
But those can't be GeV cosmic rays, right? If you're moving ahead of your program, you're moving ahead of the mass 4C.
No, you can reduce the effective speed to that, right? It's just a broad momentum distribution. And most likely one is moving at C, but some of them have forward momenta, some of them have backward momenta, and the net effective drift velocity is VA. So this is the picture after the saturation of the instability, and you know this is how they confine.
But the dispersion around that bulk is still like an order C, right?
Yeah.
So why isn't the dispersion then like the important number compared to this bulk function?
So the dispersion is important. The pitch angle also, which is like how much energy parallel to the background magnetic field is also important. I'm just trying to simplify here. But it comes in the play. And actually like this V perpendicular is related to that.
So if there is no resonance, this cosmic ray moves faster than alphan wave speed. Does that already generate shock and then this ray already loses energy because of this shock?
So there's instability, okay. Let's imagine you have a beam. You can look at the instabilities at the kind of the head of the beam.
Yeah.
Or you can look at the instability at the tail of the beam. This is what I'm doing. I'm looking at the instability at the tail of the beam, not at the front of the beam.
Yeah, Yeah, I guess I'm trying. So if you have something moved in a medium with speed faster than the, let's say, the sound speed or something, then you have a shock, right? So shock front. I'm just trying to imagine, like in this plasma, if you have your cosmic, your protons moves very fast, faster than, I don't know, this alpha wave speed or other
or the sound speed,
then do you also lose energy in that way? Like
at the front, yes. But I mean, like, you wouldn't form a shock because the density... Okay, so this is also a point I'm going to come to. So the density of cosmic rays to the background is something between 10 to the minus 4, 10 to the minus 8. So you wouldn't really form a shock. Really? So it's like that by number is very few. But because they carry a lot more energy than the background. Okay, so it's an instability that has a condition. And then the question is, okay... So we have a growth rate that's much faster. The question is this instability relevant? And if this instability grows very fast but saturated very low level, it is irrelevant. If it grows very fast and saturated high level, it is important. So this is why we had to do particle in cell simulation. I did it in this code that I called Sharp. It's 1D, 2D, 3V. And basically, the idea there is that you have particles, you deposit them on the grid to calculate the basically the currents, rho and j. These are the sources for Maxwell's equation. You solve Maxwell's equation on the grid, so you update the fields, your electromagnetic fields. Then you do some back interpolation on the particle to calculate the Lorentz force. And then using the Lorentz force, you update the particle velocity, positions, and then you cycle. It's a very simple.
Maxwell's equation is correct. How do you write it?
You write the Maxwell's equation in flat space-time.
The current. So
yeah, yeah. So the current is what updates. So you have dt. So the location of the particles tells you where you deposit, and the velocity tells you how fast this deposition or the currents are.
Right. And,
these are the sources for Maxwell's solver on a grid.
Right. So I'm trying to think what's the expression for the current.
He uses the particles to compute the current.
It's just...
Yeah, yeah. So if you have a... Oh, I see. Yeah. So if you have a cell, let's say you have a cell and you want to deposit at some ijk, you do sum over all the particles, velocity, times some kernel that basically you just account with some kernel or some weight of the particle. So basically account for the particle just in that cell. If this is a top hat or something, and then you just sum the velocities of the different particles to calculate the current. Multiply by, you know, Q and then your normalization and stuff. And so if you use typical particle cell code, it quickly becomes unstable. So you cannot run simulations with very large. We did a lot of work to basically come up with an algorithm that basically uses this idea and use higher order interpolation to make a code that is...
Why does it become unstable?
Because of electrostatic heating. So we heat the plasma numerically. So you have a numerical instability that grows secularly.
Secularly?
Yes.
Okay.
So you just heat. But then once we showed that both analytically and using basically examples that once you use higher order interpolation, you stabilize for very, very long times. And this is very important because the problem I'm going to use it for has multiple scales. So you have stuff that, you know, you have to resolve the plasma frequency, but the gyro frequency is much larger. So you have to run for very long time. So you need a code that's stable for a very long time.
So there's some things that you're saying, maybe there are red flags or playing. What do you mean by stabilized for a long time? So it's either stable or it's not.
So you have a numerical heating. There's two types of them. There's a Cherenkov instability and there is the electrostatic heating. Once you use the fifth...
Electrostatic instability, is that just a fancy misnomer for some...
No, it's something you can calculate analytically. It's aliasing. It's an aliasing for in the Fourier space comes because of discretizing, because you're using two descriptions. On the gradient, you solve the electromagnetic, you use Eulerian description, but the particles, you move them in the Lagrangian fashion.
Okay.
And this coupling.
But I would still call that a numerical graph divergence.
Yeah, yeah, it is numerical instability, yes.
And then there's a fancy physical terminology behind it, electrostatic, whatever.
Yeah, just the type of the how the codex loads, basically, yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
And this is something that in the limit of what infinite particles will go away? Or...
Yeah. So once you go to the smooth limit, you get basically back the equations you want.
You were saying, I thought that this is happening due to aliasing of modes that are, you know, modes that are larger than Nyquist getting alias back into the box, right? Like, so that's the origin, and if you increase the number of particles, that won't change, right?
I mean, how fast it happens, it changes.
Yeah.
So basically, imagine. Yeah, yeah.
Like aliasing can go to infinity. You know, the grid resolution is still infinity, right?
Yeah. So basically, you take the continuum limit, this goes away. So delta x goes to zero, delta t goes to zero, number of particles increases to infinity.
Okay.
And this is the limit of the continuum. And this is, yeah. So you have an instability because of the two different types of discretization. Yeah. And it grows cyclically, and then we have a way to deal with it. And okay, so this is the simulation we run for the cosmic ray streaming. So we run a simulation that we can calculate the, so basically you have electron ion and electron ion cosmic rays traveling with density ratio. So the alphanic velocity in the background is 0.1c, 0.01c, the realistic mass ratio, the relative drift is 5 times the alphanic velocity. V perpendicular is basically, so you have a particle that is moving with some velocity. V perpendicular is basically the square root of Vy, Vz squared. This is how, basically gives you the pitch angle of these cosmic rays. And we're kind of looking at just the population of cosmic rays with a given velocity and given pitch angle and look at the instabilities, and then we want to simulate it in kinetic simulation and see magnetic field amplification. And if you do this, this is what you get. You get basically two phases, one of them that grows fast, and this is the growth rate of the intermediate scale instability. This is the growth rate of the gyro scale instability, the smaller one. And of course, we run here with, like, you know, VA is much higher than realistic parameter. The ratio also, the cosmic ray density to the background density is 10 to the minus 2, so it's also not very realistic. This is why the difference between the growth rates at the small k, large scale, and the large k, small scale, the intermediate scale instability is just a factor of 5. In reality, it's something like 20, 50.
What happens when saturations occur? Why is that chance around? What physically is going undergoing?
Yeah, yeah. So basically, so here you grow the instability and then you scatter. So you start growing backward, propagating moves, because some cosmic rays, instead of moving in this direction, start moving not aligned with the magnetic field in the opposite direction. This is why you have these dips. So at some phases, cosmic rays are giving magnetic field energy or growing magnetic field energy. And some other phases, they're actually gaining energy because they lost a lot of their energy.
But then after doing what happens at T 1.2 on the series, it turns around and begins to decay.
Yeah, yeah. I'll show a movie here. Just
turn around again and historically go back to the...
No, it's kind of saturated here.
So for the particles in the PIC code, are they all moving at the same?
The cosmic ray ions moving, all of them at the same drift velocity.
With no dispersion.
With no dispersion, yes. So we basically, you have this wide.
The gyro radii are still computed, assuming that they're moving at the speed of light, roughly.
No. The gyro radius depends on this population. So basically, you have this wide population of cosmic rays. So we picked some one of them with some pitch angle. And we looked at what kind of instability is this population. I mean, the total instability would be the population that all the total instability would be the instabilities that produced by all these populations, right?
But
But these oscillations you were showing, presumably, you will get damped if you put in dispersion in the velocities, right?
Not really, no. No. I mean, it would change the growth rates. But this oscillation is, I think it's a cascade problem. And so let me just show this movie. This is so this movie, again, shows the magnetic field amplification here. This is the V parallel and V perpendicular for cosmic ray ions. They start all at this star. This is the real space magnetic field. This is the magnetic field in Fourier space. So these two black lines, this is where you have this large scale instability. This is the new instability at the red lines. And we just run the simulation. This is what happens initially. Start growing stuff at the intermediate scale instability, and see them here, and this parallel scatter cosmic ray ions. And here you start having this dip once they start changing the direction, their parallel drift direction. But then at some point, so you have a inverse cascade from the small scale to larger scale. So this is why you grow these, they're also unstable, but the growth rate here is much faster. So you can see there is a cascade. Then at some point you grow the gyroscale instability and then you start scattering. So this is the, you know, the scattering, if you isotropize in the alphane frame, this is why you drop the average drift velocity to the alphane velocity. So we have instability, but the problem is like we can just run these simulations for a very long time, but we don't really understand or we don't know what happens at realistic barometers. So just to summarize, we have a new instability that is very fast, drive ion cyclotron waves, they grow if there is a condition, and they are much faster in realistic barometers than in the gyroscale instability, or this is the instability that people usually use to do this streaming self-confinement picture. So it has two, well, many implications, but you can classify it into two. One of them that we speculated about is that they will impact, you know, within the self-confinement picture, because the growth rate is higher, the scattering frequency is higher, so, and the pressure gradient they would produce is higher, so you can launch galactic winds that are much faster, and this is actually consistent with some edge-on galaxies that we observe, gamma rays from edge-on galaxies that we observe, and they could, you know, impact also the star formation if you run simulations and stuff like this. And this is something we will have known the last maybe 15 years. We will have run, you know, ISM simulation, galaxy, isolated galaxy simulation, cosmological simulation with cosmic rays. And once you change the diffusion barometer a little bit, things change quite a bit. So this is just saying that you're going to change the transport quite a bit. So this means that you would also change the evolution of these galaxies quite a bit. But how much depends on the nonlinear saturation realistic barometer? And this is, I'll just talk a little bit about what we're trying to do to understand the nonlinear saturation at realistic barometers. But another thing was from this instability, because it's a resonance with the electron branch, we said that this can, you know, solve this electron injection problem. And this is what I'll try to focus on, hopefully today. So basically, so the best simulation for this instabilities that people have run was that this is VA over C, and this is N cosmic rays over NI. So this gives you basically the separation in temporal scale. This also gives you the growth rate, but also dictates how far the modes you grow from the modes from the cell size in your simulations. And the best simulation that people have run was at 10 to the minus 1, 10 to the minus 1. And it is because that could, if you run it for longer, it's unstable. So we run this simulation I just showed you. It was 10 to the minus 2, 10 to the minus 2, but it's still quite far from realistic barometers. This is VA over C in different in different astrophysical regimes. So what can we do? I thought about after finding this, and the reason why I want to go to the realistic barometer is that the saturation regime at 10 to the minus 1, 10 to the minus 1 was different from the saturation regime at 10 to the minus 2, 10 to the minus 2. So you cannot just assume it is now different, but this is the best I can do, so the rest is the same. So we need to do better to study the saturation. If you want to make big claims, you need to do hard work. So what I did was to, it's very hard even in 1D3V, is to replace the background ions from the kinetic description to the fluid description. So I have fluid electrons, fluid ions. So this is, imagine now you have your three-dimensional real space. Every direction has some velocity. And then yeah, we assume that there is two directions where everything is uniform. So the spatial derivative along y and z is zero. Exactly. So you don't have any moves propagating. There is no k, y, k, z. This is what 1D3V is. So the nonlinear saturation happened also by inverse cascade, and the cascade, turbulent cascade, we know it works differently in different dimensions, so we also need to go to higher dimension. So, but before we go to higher dimension, this is basically the simulations that I told you at 10 to the minus 1, 10 to the minus 1. This is what people usually did. And this is the the red curve is what you get from kinetic simulations, and the blue curve is what you get from a kinetic simulation, but you replace the background with just fluid. And you get like almost exactly the same growth in the magnetic field. But if you go to 10 to the minus 2, 10 to the minus 2, so this is also with realistic mass ratio. So you have these two phases of the instabilities, the intermediate scale instability and the gyro scale instability or the streaming instability. And if you do ideal fluid, so the fluid I have is an ideal or some adiabatic index. And this is what you get, a little bit of a difference. So this was the first project I gave to my PhD student, Ruben. And he looked at the differences between these two. And it looked like part of the nonlinear saturation happens because of Landau damping. So you have multiple Alphen waves. They interact. They produce parallel electric field because they don't have the same phase, the same wavelength. And in the kinetic simulations, you have Landau damping, which is basically at some waves, the electrostatic perturbation damp. This is the famous Landau damping. And part of this was the case. So he implemented basically this non-local Landau damping closures in the fluid. This is like something that people have been doing in accelerator physics also. And you can see that, you know, bring it a bit closer, but not fully. So we're still trying to understand like these differences and also pushing it to realistic parameters because we can now. But for the 2D, so we know that the saturation happened. Of course, the 2D is much more expensive. This is also the 2D version. So now, instead of having the derivative along two directions to be zero, just along the z direction, so you have an x and y. And this is basically different field components. It's the same setup as the one 10 to minus 2, 10 to minus 2. This is the number density for cosmic ray electrons, ions. This is their velocity distribution. I'm gonna run this movie. You can see initially, this also happened in 1D, you excite some electrostatic perturbation. This is a part of the dispersion relation that I didn't show you. Then you heat the cosmic ray electrons. But then at some point you start growing these intermediate scale modes. This is the characteristic wavelengths that you have here in the magnetic field. And you get a scattering of cosmic ray ions in the parallel direction. And quickly they dominate the electric and magnetic perturbation. And you can use this simulation and compare it to 1D3V. And this is what we have. This is the magnetic field amplification. This is during the intermediate scale instability phase. This is the 1D in the blue. The red is the 2D. Of course, in 2D, I couldn't run very large box in the parallel direction because it's very expensive. This is why it kind of saturates here, doesn't grow the other large scale mode. And of course, to do this in realistic parameters and resolve all the instabilities, you have to also replace the fluid, the background with ideal fluid. This has been done with Landau closure. Proven also is taking care of this, and hopefully we have a paper soon about that. So we have instability, has a potential of, you know, changing how we understand cosmic ray transport in the galaxy and their dynamical impacts. But we really need to understand its nonlinear saturation. And basically, I tried to highlight what we're trying to do that. But the other thing is that there is this famous electron injection problem in supernova remnants. At least in supernova remnants, it also exists everywhere in other. And I'll tell you what is this, but I'll show you. I wanted to show you first this supernova remnant 1006. It's one of the brightest. I mean, it's 1006. This is when we first observed it. So there is a historical record for it. And this is the view of the supernova remnant in the X-ray. So you have this thermal X-ray from electrons here, and you have these blue one overlying on them. And this comes, these are in the radio, and this is from relativistic electrons gyrating around the background magnetic field that's along these polar caps. And of course, you have a shock.
This is a real image?
This is a real image, yes, from Chandra. The X-ray is from Chandra. Okay. So the problem is how, so these, basically, these are the supernova shocks. And the problem is, how would you accelerate electrons at the supernova? Observationally, we know they do get accelerated. But how would you do that? So this is the famous electron injection problem that people have failed to solve for a very, very long time. So basically, you have a shock. Then you have a magnetic perturbation in the two sides of the shock. And if you imagine a proton coming in this direction, scatter back and forth. And because in the two sides of the shock, in the shockless frame, these magnetic perturbations in the two sides are merging toward the shock, the ion that is bouncing back and forth gains energy. And this is the famous Fermi 1 acceleration. The problem for electrons to do that is that these perturbations are of the order of the gyroscale of the ions, because they are usually also excited by the ions. So if you now think about electrons with the same speed, the gyro radius would be smaller by a factor of 2,000. So instead of scattering back and forth, they would just gyrate around this magnetic perturbation and get transported from one side to the other. So using this, you cannot have electron acceleration shocks, but we see them. So how this can happen? So of course, you need a magnetic perturbation on a small scale that can resonate with the electron. And this is why we kind of speculated when we found this instability that this can solve the problem. But of course, this can scatter electrons, but how efficient? This is why we have to run particle simulations. So let's check with Beck. So we have an instability that has a condition, so we can run shock simulations. One shock simulation where the instability condition is fulfilled, one shock simulation that the instability condition is not fulfilled, and then just compare how efficient the electron acceleration in these two shocks. So that just the setup with an electron positron beam that is moving in the negative direction, and here there is a reflecting wall. This is just to mimic that you have exactly symmetric two electron positron beam, but you simulate just one half. And this is basically I'll run this movie, but after I show you the magnetic field amplification. this is the magnetic field, and this is the number density of the electron and positron. This is basically the parallel velocity for electrons and ions. And on the top there is the spectrum in different regions. But if we run two simulations, of course, the instability has an inequality. It's an inequality. You can violate the inequality two ways. So one way is to lower so for a given alphanic Mach number, this can be translated to V drift over VA. And so the red simulation fulfill the instability condition. The black one does not by lowering the mass ratio. And if you look at the at the downstream region, so this is the region where you shocked the plasma, and you look at the magnetic field amplification, you can see that you have much more in the small scale magnetic field amplification, and it's actually rotating like electrons in the red simulations. But then the question is like, how efficient is the electron acceleration in this simulation? And this is the answer. This is just at one time stamp. If you look at momentum distribution of electrons in these two different shocks, you can see here, like, you heat much more, you accelerate electrons. The gyro radius of the ions, which is basically the wavelengths of the modes that you have, the large scale modes that you have in the two shocks on the two sides of the shock front, is about here. So if these cosmic rays can be injected into DSA, all these electrons can be injected to DSA. So this shows that you heat the electrons, you accelerate them, and you inject them into DSA. And if you, this is an instability condition, so one sanity check I did was to, okay, I violated it by lowering the mass ratio, but there is a problem with that because you change the separation of scales. But if I, if I use a realistic mass ratio, I just increase the alphanic Mach number, which is basically effectively increase V drift over VA, so you miss the instability condition. And you can see that a huge difference in the acceleration efficiency of the electrons. Okay, so I have some efficiency. Is that reasonable? I'm going to show you just first the movie. So this is the simulation where we have efficient electron acceleration. You see forming these moods that have the gyroscale of the incident ions. And this is their momentum distribution. You can see here you're accelerating ions by this scattering back and forth at the shock front. But for electrons, you're actually scattering, accelerating them everywhere in the shock downstream. I can say much more about the movie, but I want to make a couple of points before. So basically, so you have this momentum distribution. You can ask what kind of what is the non-thermal energy in the ions and electrons, and this is how we do it. We have a moment, the red lines, these are momentum distribution in the simulations. So we, the peak basically tells you what is the temperature in this U to the 4 Fu versus U. And so this is a Maxwell Jotner distribution. This gives you the temperature of the plasma. And basically you go a little bit further and then calculate the energy here and here. And this is basically the non-thermal energy in the electrons and ions. And this KEI or KBI, EP, is basically the ratio that people usually need to do this modeling of electron acceleration of shocks. And this is its evolution. So you just compare it. You have at least a factor of 100 more efficient electron acceleration in the simulations where you have the instability. So this is a 3D MHD simulation that people tried to use to basically mimic the multi-wavelength observation of this 10OSEX. This is 10OSEX. This is in the radio. This is in the X-ray. This is in the gamma ray. This basically comes from proton accelerating, accelerated when they're leaving, reduce bion, the bion decay, give you gamma rays. This is thermal X-rays, basically. And this is the radio, comes from electrons moving, rotating around magnetic field and emitting synchrotron radiation. So these people tried to run these basically 3D MHD simulations and ISM. This is really a blast. You have a 3D MHD and just explode, so you're really starting from the state of Taylor phase of the evolution. And then basically they tweak the barometer, which is one of them is this KEI, to get this radio emission, and they split it into basically three parts, and then you can fit the radial profile of the three parts and try to do, you know, fit the barometer such that you have the best fit you can. Basically, this is the best fit, and then you can ask what is KEI that they found or they needed. And it is this. There's something between these two lines. So I have something that is, I would claim, is consistent with the observation. Then you would ask, okay, but it saturates at a lower level. It's fine. In their model, they were using MHD, and they assume that the electron and ion temperature is the same. But in the simulation, they are not. If you look at the electron-ion temperature, the ratio is about 0.4. This is actually very interesting if you think about interplanetary shocks, but I'm going to skip this part. So just to summarize, we have a new instability. It has a fast growth rate. It has a lot of potential of impacting the transport and thus galaxy evolution. But also we showed that, you know, on the side, it actually solved a very long-standing problem, which is the electron injection of shocks. And we really needed true mass ratio to get the electron heating correctly in the shocks, and this is important. So just as a bigger view, that will end in 3 minutes. So this is the famous EHT image. This is the polarized light. And if you run GRMHD for these simulations, actually cannot find a fit. So if you assume that the electrons and ions have the same temperature, and you find a simulation that matches your observation, they overproduce in the X-ray. So by hand, you have to lower the electron temperature near the black hole to basically the average gamma of B30. But this is all by hand. Okay, so yeah, we lower the electron temperature. And is this the whole story? The problem is that no, yes, we have a better fit, but these GRMHT simulations give you much higher variability than what we see. So you really need to understand both how you accelerate or get these electrons with these energies around black holes, and actually how kinetic versus MHT or force-free stuff impact the variability of these accretion disks. Yes?
Does the GRMHT simulations, the variability problem won't happen if they just start, right? But instead, I would assume there's very little variability. Only if they just start that we see a significant more variability than the root thing. But this image we're seeing here is extended. So what comparison will I try to do?
There is, if you look at the light curve, there is some variability that we don't see in object. I mean, yes, there is variability in the MHD simulations, but you know, in the GR-MHD simulations for M87 and for Sergio Star. And for Sergio Star, slower mass, the GR-MHD gives you much, much more variability than what we see. It's a bit lower in M87. But the idea is that this kind, understanding how electrons get accelerated and the impact of this kinetic physics on these is, you know, it's important to understand if this variability is something that we're missing from observation. Are we averaging over in the observations? Or is this something real? You know, I mean, maybe you can find some things that you can find from the simulation that doesn't really depend on, you know, depends only on the space-time or something, and then you can take this from the GRMHT. But there is a lot of upcoming observations of multi-year or many more observations, even if M87. So if you really want to use this observation to really understand the space-time, the conditions of the plasma around these black holes, you really need to have a good modeling for it. It's just one example where electron kinetics are important. You can also look at the, this is the famous Gamminga-Bassar. Some people know about it. So the story there is that you have this, you know, strongly rotating magnetized neutron star, and it's emitting electron positrons, and we observe them in the gamma rays, and you can convert, because these gamma rays, you have relativistic electron positrons, they upscatter CMB photons, and you get these gamma ray halos. This is what Hawke found in 2017 and was recently also confirmed from Hess. And now, so the exercise there was, I know the energy of these electron positron pairs. I can, and this is an inverse Compton cascade, I can calculate the time scale by which you cool off these pairs. So I have a time scale where the pairs would lose their energy. And then I can use the size of the halo that I found from observation to calculate the diffusion coefficient. It's basically the size squared over the time. So you can infer the diffusion coefficient in the diffusion picture. You can infer a diffusion coefficient if these are diffusing, and you calculate a diffusion coefficient. The problem with that is the diffusion coefficient here that you calculate from these halos is 100 times smaller than the average galactic diffusion coefficient. And some people said maybe it's an environmental impact, but if you do similar exercise, but this is from the bion decay around these are two famous supernova remnants, and try to infer the diffusion coefficient around them, you get roughly the average galactic diffusion coefficient. So it's not an environmental thing. It's something lacking in our understanding of how charged particles get transported in plasma environments. Another maybe a larger scale example is this. This is one of these Abel galaxy clusters. This is Abel 2256. This is in the radio, hundreds of megahertz. And you can see here, this is the relativistic jet. This is another jet from some galaxy. But what we don't understand is that these basically filaments. And people have tried to do modeling for these. And these are basically weak cluster shocks. Spans maybe here 100 megaparsecs, but in other galaxy clusters, it could even span megaparsecs. And we don't understand. So this is like in the radio, they come from synchrotron emission, also from electrons, and we don't understand how electrons get accelerated these shocks. These shocks are different from the supernova shocks because the sonic Mach number here is very low, it's a few. So, so we don't understand the acceleration, or we didn't understand the acceleration in strong shocks and also at weak shocks. The instability is actually more favored in these conditions. And recently we hired a postdoc, and she's actually doing the simulations for these conditions to see whether the instability can actually explain the luminosity that we see at these objects. So many, many more potential impacts coming, not just from the instability, also from using the tools that we developed to understand that. So thank you for your attention.
Questions?
Diffusion.
Yeah.
So this is a calculation you can do something similar to Kalbrop. And in Kalbrop you have to assume some diffusion coefficient, right? And we know in some instances it doesn't work. This is one case, you know.
It doesn't work in the sense that you compare data from
with observation. So here for electron positron it doesn't work because the prediction from a Kalbrop type code here would be that if you use the normal galactic diffusion coefficient, the size of this halo would be 10 times larger, the luminosity of it would be 100 times smaller on the sky, and Hawke wouldn't be able to see it. This is why it was surprising for them that they saw it, because they expected luminosity was much lower than their sensitivity. So this is one type thing. You can do also calculate something called the Gamaga, which is basically the surface density of gamma ray halos coming from proton accelerated at supernova shocks, and calculate the diffusion coefficient. Some supernova it works, some doesn't. But if you want to like average distribution of heavier metals in galaxies, it does work. So
it does work.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I have like a really basic question, which is I guess that yeah, we know this. Cosmic ray state from Auger, like measure that, and we know more than the speed energy.
Mm-hmm.
And people have been playing, I guess, I'm not in the field at all, but people have been playing for decades with Kalbrop and etc., I guess, to more or less match this, right? So, with your instabilities, would those instabilities modify the spectrum in some way, the measured spectrum by Auger? Would it make it softer?
So the short answer is I don't know. My guess would be that it wouldn't on average, but it would change the distribution.
And which energies do you expect the instability?
GeV.
It's
yeah.
Mostly GeV.
Yeah. Okay. I mean, can it impact heavier elements? Yes, you can hand wave a little bit and see like maybe few tens of GeV, yes. But you need to show that. I haven't done that.
But wouldn't your instabilities make the spectrum softer because you're removing somehow momentum from the cosmic rays, right? So wouldn't you like if there's a GeV instability there, wouldn't there be a small dip there in the spectrum that you should observe?
I mean, it's not straightforward like this because it's playing a role in the transport but also in the acceleration. So it's basically also transferring energy from GeV protons to maybe a few hundred MeV electrons.
Yeah.
So it's a non-linear thing. So I wouldn't do this linear extrapolation. But including correct transport coefficient or more transport coefficients in code like Kalbrop, I think it's important.
I guess you cannot really do it because, as you said, your simulations are not really capturing the physical parameters.
Yeah. Now, for now, yes. Mm-hmm.
Along those lines, so you said you're doing the latitude and the latitude. Have you tried just doing sort of the range you can do and extrapolating? Or is it kind of too complicated to extrapolate?
I think it's too complicated because, like, we don't fully understand the saturation mechanism. And even with partial understanding, we see that it changes. So you really need to understand the saturation, how it really actually saturates. I mean, Ruben is doing a lot of work, and we're writing a paper now, and looks like we maybe 70% understand, maybe. But also, it's more complicated in 2D, so we really have to, you know, compare because the cascade is different.
One bit that changes turbulent cascades a lot is going from 2D to 3D.
Yes.
So what's the prospect of doing one of these things in 3D?
Maybe in the next 5 years. I mean, it's much more expensive.
Of course.
Yes.
Is it possible?
It is.
Okay.
So I think with this fluid idea, I think it is possible. But it's going to be quite expensive. I mean, like, just to run this 10 to minus 10, 10 to minus 2, 10 to minus 2 thing, even in the 1D, we had to, like, optimize the code. We have to, like, think about, like, jumping in memory, parallelization, like, fitting stuff in different levels of cache. And if you miss this, you can go from, like, a simulation that 10 million CPU hours to a few hundred million CPU hours, and you cannot run this, but you can do this. It's like we're kind of at the edge.
Okay. So even the 1D simulations are already
in
CPU hours.
Yeah. So the 3D now, I have a version that runs on GPU, so hopefully this would kind of give us some factor, but
yeah.
I don't know how much in 3D. But yeah.
Right, if no more questions, let's thank Mohammed again.
Mm-hmm.